This episode of Alone is sponsored by our GoDaddy coupon code CJCSiglerC, which gets you a new .com domain for just 99 cents. Talk about a cool Christmas present for the person who has everything. Get a .com for their dream business, or your dream business, for their kids, or your kids, or as a gag gift like, hey, Bill, I bought you a .com. You are a snotty little wanker.com. It's all yours. That's the GoDaddy coupon code CJCSiglerC. Learn more at scottsigler.com/GoDaddy. And now on with our story.
Welcome to the serial audiobook Alone, an unabridged podcast of Book 3 of the Generations trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Performed by A. Kovacs. This novel is available in print as an ebook or as a full-length unabridged audiobook. For links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Audible, please visit scottsigler.com/alone.
What up, junkies? A Real Girl and I are back from a trip to Los Angeles to Hollywood. We had a couple of pitch meetings and made a little progress, but there's nothing going on for sure. In Hollywood, nothing is for sure ever. Really more just a couple of leads and some possibilities to move forward than any serious interest in anything. But we will keep you informed. Every time we go up, we make progress. We learn a little bit more about the people, the industry, how things work. It is a process, but we know we will get a TV show. The only variable is time. But now that we are back from that trip, it's time for me to dive into Mount Fitzroy. The first draft of the sequel Earth Corps is going well. It's going as well as a first draft can go. You never really know what you're going to have until you finish it and start to go through the second draft. But no, we still don't have a publication date. We have no idea even when I will complete the first draft. My goal is to have the first draft done by December 31st so that I start 2018 with my second draft of GFL Book 6. We'll see how that works out. But back to the story at hand. Let's get you caught up on Alone. And then we're going to mine some bitcoins. Previously on Alone, M and her friends try to understand the nature of the orbital assault. The attack could have easily destroyed Ukmal if the attackers had used enough force. But despite the deaths and the destroyed buildings, the attackers seemed to, as Spingate put it, go easy on the birthday children. Why? M makes the trip to the top of the towering observatory to try and understand it all.
I climb the circular metal steps that take me to the observatory's top layer. The walls glow soft white around me. Just above, I see a bit of the sky, mostly hidden by a large stone slab supported by four golden poles. When we first climbed the observatory's 3,000 steps, that slab was flush with the observatory's top layer. The slab supported a tall pillar decorated with bishop-sized symbols of the grown-ups: circle at top, then circle star, double ring, circle cross, half circle, and gear. Aramofsky pressed his hand into a palm print inside that gear. The platform rose up on those poles, revealing this staircase that led down into the gargantuan building. I feel the morning heat even before I finish the climb. Maybe 2 hours until the reddish sun is directly overhead, and already the day is the hottest we've had in weeks. I step between the golden poles and onto the top plateau. The first thing I notice is the large carbon symbol engraved across the stone beneath my feet. I always notice it, because O'Malley was the first of us to see it. Even though we still don't know its full significance, it always makes me think of him. This spot truly is the top of our world. I can see forever. The sweltering sun bakes mist from the yellow jungle ruins. The tallest trees look like grass. Ukmal's city walls and buildings are like child's toys. Snow-capped mountains rise up to the west. To the north, the lake that feeds the river flowing into our city. To the northeast, the crescent-shaped clearing where Aramofsky fought the Springer King, where I defeated the belligerents. The clearing has a black smudge in the center, the remnants of Callie's cornfield. All of it, from north to west to south to east and back again. This is my home. The lake. Sometimes when I see that blue surface, I have the tiniest bit of Matilda memory. A red canoe. My grandpa smiling, laughing. It should be a happy memory, but it isn't. It bothers me. I push the splinter of memory away and walk to the plateau's edge. Far below, I see the plaza, a thumbnail-sized tan square. On it, Zimbal is a tiny gleam of silver. No damage to the shuttle or the plaza. If I believed in gods, I'd thank them for that miracle. Although, if gods were real, then I'd have to ask them why they let the attack happen in the first place. The best miracle would be no attack at all, wouldn't it? The area all around the observatory is untouched. Beyond that, though, I see the attack's carnage. Beautiful Ukmal, the stone city built for the birthday children, is pockmarked and ravaged. The residential area is ripped apart like fresh-turned farmland. Bits of buildings stick up like cracked brown bones. Rings of black surround each crater, where flames were hot enough to dry out the wet vines and set them ablaze. The slightest breeze stirs blackened ash into tiny, spinning whirlwinds. Down there, 9 of us died. Down there, a flying stone ripped away Halim's throat. Down there, somewhere, is my spear. I want it. Maybe the wood shaft burned up. Maybe the blade melted. I don't care. I will find it. Even if it is a melted lump of metal, I will have Borjigin hammer it into a new weapon, a weapon I swear I will use on the aliens who did this to us. Matilda destroyed the Springer City. She killed thousands, maybe millions. I know that if there really are gods, if there is justice, her descendants might have to pay for her crimes. I know this, yet I don't care. The birthday children did nothing to deserve such punishment. We are not responsible for the actions of those who came before us. If we must suffer for our own sins, so be it, but we will not give up our blood for crimes committed by others. Something about the bomb craters bothers me. Why didn't they attack the observatory? If the aliens destroyed the places where we walked the most, congregated the most, why wouldn't they hit the place where most of us live? It makes no sense. I look up at the stone slab. A rope ladder dangles from it. I climb. When I reach the top, I see 3 boys lying on their backs, eyes closed. Nevins and Pyrrha are Gears, scientists, like Spingate and Zubiri. Harmon is a Circle, like me. I've spent a little time with him. For lack of a better way to say it, he just isn't very smart. He's here to help the other two, to be their assistant. Nevins couldn't be more skinny, while Pyrrha has steadily gained weight since he awoke. Both boys have straight black hair and chocolate brown skin. If it wasn't for the difference in their bodies, they could be mistaken for brothers. Harmon is already taller than I am, thick with muscle. When he's full grown, he'll be a red-haired giant, bigger than Farrar, maybe even bigger than Bishop. The poor boy burns so easily, though. He's going to be feeling the effects of this little nap all over his small nose and freckled face. The thick pillar lies on its side. When I first saw it, I thought it was stone. I was wrong. It's some man-made material. Tough and strong, but hollow. The contents of the pillar are spread about the slab, bits and pieces of disassembled machinery. Those bits once made an antenna capable of communicating with the stars. Some of the parts are shiny, almost new, but many are melted blobs. Tangles of colored wire are spread out like spilled wax. This collection of pieces is a puzzle, yes, but not the kind of puzzle I could ever solve. Having a good nap, boys? They lurch to their feet so fast I'm surprised they don't pee themselves. They look terrified, as if I am a hurricane and not a girl that is barely taller than any of them. "Em," Armin says, "I, we, there was thinking and we, and you." He's stammering nonsense. Not the smartest of the three, but at least he had the courage to actually speak. "I need this antenna fixed," I say. "Now, not later, not after you've had a nice rest." They look at each other, frightened anew. "But Grandmaster Spingate told you," Nevin said. "She said she did. We can't fix it. We can't." I point to the spot where they were just lying. "So you think you can just go to sleep instead? People are dying, you lazy fools." They shrivel in place, shoulders hunched, eyes cast down. Maybe they'd rather have a hurricane sneak up on them than face me when I'm angry.
"Viva trying to think," Pyrrha says.
He has a communication jewel in his left ear. His voice is thin and light, little different from the wind that usually whips across this tiny plateau.
"Sibiri told us to do that from time to time. To stop and just think. We've done everything we know how to do, Em. Some of the parts are broken for good. It's just, well, some things can't be fixed."
I think of Halim. He was broken, too. His parts could not be fixed. Yelling at these boys isn't going to magically make them smarter. "So you were thinking," I say, lowering my voice, making it softer. "Did you think of anything?" The three of them shake their heads as if they are one body.
"We need help," Pyrrha says. "Can Zubiri help us for a while?"
If the telescope really is a weapon, I can't spare Zubiri from that project, not even for an instant.
"I guess you better lie back down for a while and think some more," I say. "I don't care what Spingate told you. Zubiri is busy. You three need to fix this antenna. Everyone's lives depend on it."
I don't know if that last part is true or not. Reaching the Zolittle and letting Bello talk to her friends might make a difference. It might not. If it could possibly help our survival, though, these boys must find a way. There is always a solution. Always.
"Get back to work," I say.
I turn towards the rope ladder, then pause. The cityscape seems to shift. The buildings are already tiny bumps to my eyes, yet they change. They blend together into a shapeless brown mass.
The craters.
How could I not have seen it right away? The shape isn't perfect, but now that I've seen it, I can't unsee it. A wide circle with the plaza at dead center. The meteor attack didn't avoid a specific building. It avoided an area. Pyrrha rushes to me, tugs on my sleeve. He's holding his left pointer finger against his communication jewel in his ear, as if he has to focus hard to understand what he's hearing.
"Spingate wants you in the control room," he says. "Zubiri, fix the telescope!"
XVII. The elevator stops. I step out into a control room alive with activity. A glowing image of the observatory hovers above the well. It's an image I've seen 100 times, but there is something new. Halfway up each side, on the 90-degree corners, are glowing orange dots. Spingate, Zubiri, and Gaston are standing on the platform. Spin adjusts her sling. Little Kevin is fussing, crying softly.
Spin whispers something comforting, but the baby doesn't stop. I quickly walk past the students at their pedestals. No lessons today. Each display shows some part of the observatory. I catch glimpses of a weapon I have not seen before, boxy and tan with a long black barrel sticking out of it. No, 6 barrels, all bunched together. I step onto the platform. Spingate looks up from her work. She's afraid. Something has disturbed her right down to her core.
"Zubiri did it," she says. "Or Omotiodal did because of the attack. Zubiri isn't sure yet. The telescope is working. We have visuals on the alien ships. All of them."
Her words hang in the air. I glance at Zubiri. She nods slightly. "I've waited months for this. We all have." I point to the floating observatory.
"Then why are you showing that instead of our enemies?"
"The attack activated systems we didn't know existed," Gaston says. "Those orange dots are anti-missile batteries. Opkik and the Haves are examining them now, seeing if any of them still work. If the aliens bombard us again, we might be able to hit their meteors before they impact, break them up so they don't cause as much damage." I feel a rush of mixed emotions. Hope and excitement that we might be able to defend ourselves against the next strike. Anger that these systems sat idle while 9 of my people died.
"Why didn't they activate during the attack?"
"I did not know they existed, Empress."
Omotiodal's voice echoes through the room.
"The orbital bombardment overrode some of the programming blocks that were put into my system long ago."
I'd give anything to find out who screwed up the computer's memory. I don't believe in torture, but for that person, I might make an exception.
"All right," I say. "Show me our enemy."
"You need to see the Zolotl first," Gaston says to me.
"Teresa, put it up on the main display."
He isn't asking Spingate, he's commanding her. In Zimbel's cockpit, where his authority is unquestioned, this is what he sounds like. I've never heard him use that tone with her anywhere else. She obeys instantly.
"On main display," she says.
The air above the well sparkles to life. Multicolored flecks gather and glow, swell to blobs, then shrink, rush together, and take shape. A cylinder. Copper in color, pitted, scratched and gouged all along its length. I think of the drawing Spingate made in the dust so long ago, when she said we had walked in a circle. The part of the cylinder facing Omayokin ends in a flat, squashed cartoon face surrounded by a ring of small images I can't quite make out. It reminds me of the Mictlan symbol stitched into our black coveralls and our red ties. Just past the cartoon face, a tiny tube sticks out of the cylinder, ending in a small sphere. The sphere is barely a speck compared to the Zolotl's massive size, yet I know what it must be. The crystal ball, the place where we first learned we were on a spaceship and not in an endless dungeon. At the cylinder's far end, a slightly smaller tube juts out, points away from the planet. This tube is a mishmash of pipes and machinery, gray and silver and teal, tapering to a narrow black cone. Gaston steps off the platform and walks to the well. He hops onto the red wall, balancing there, walking around its flat, narrow top with the grace of a circle star.
"This is where we were when we woke up," he says,
pointing to a section of the Zolotl near the crystal ball. The area he indicates is small, barely more than the tip of the huge ship. He then points to the middle of the copper-colored tube.
"We have no idea what's in here," he says. "That's the part the grown-ups sealed off. The part past the end of the garden, perhaps."
He reaches out, grabbing the image of the Zolotl, rotating it. He spreads his hands, making a section bigger. I see a long, deepening groove that ends in a flat, gray door that would open like a set of huge jaws.
"Landing bay," he says. "Inside that door is where our shuttle was. And this..."
He runs his fingers across the gray, silver, and teal section, lets them linger on the tapering black tube.
"Is the Zolotl's main engine. This is what brought us here."
His voice is full of awe. Aramofsky had his gods. Gaston has this.
"They trained me to command that ship," he says. "Now that I've actually seen it, Em, so much of my training is flooding back. Just like with Zimbal. I had to show you that to show you this. Put the basilisk on the display."
The Zolotl blinks out. The air above the well sparkles. An image coalesces. It's the same image I was looking at.
"You just put the Zolotl up again," I say.
Gaston shakes his head.
"Look at the colors."
"What is he talking about? It's the Zolotl. The long, tubular, copper-colored shape, the section with the machinery and pipes, the tapering engine cone, the section with the machinery, the pipes. The colors are different. Gleaming dark reds, cobalt blues. And the front of the ship, the flat, circular end that points towards Omayokan, it doesn't have the squashed cartoon face. The front of the ship is gray. On that gray disc, in thick black lines, are the two rings and seven dots of the carbon symbol." I glance at the well wall, knowing a matching symbol is etched into it, black on red instead of black on gray. "The two ships are almost the same," I say. Zubiri steps off the platform, slowly walks to the well. She stares up at the image, her wide-eyed face bathed in reflected light. "Our ship and the basilisk came from completely different areas of space," she says. "Millions of light years apart, yet they look like almost identical designs. How can that be?" Spingate and Gaston say nothing. They don't know either.
"Maybe it's a coincidence," I say.
Zubiri shakes her head.
"Impossible. Teresa, please show her."
"Putting Gamma 1 on the display," Spingate says.
Gamma 1. The goblin. The basilisk fuzzes out. The image that replaces it is smaller, perhaps because the goblin is further away from us. It is not quite as detailed as the first two, but there is no mistaking what I see. A thick, copper-colored cylinder, a smaller tube sticking out the back, tapering to a black engine cone. The goblin's circular front is deep green, semi-translucent like glass. Etched on it in yellow lines is a curling symbol with thorn-like points. I don't know what that symbol is.
"Now, show me the dragon," Gaston says.
Standing atop the red wall, fists on his hips, silhouetted in the display's light, he looks so commanding. He reminds me of Bishop. He reminds me of me. The image blurs, fuzzes, crystallizes, becomes clear. The smallest of the four ships I've seen so far is the least detailed, yet there is zero doubt. The dragon looks like the goblin, which looks like the basilisk, which looks like our Zolotl. The dragon's flat circular front is pure white, no symbol. The part tapering away from the copper-colored cylinder's far end is also white. The black engine cone looks identical.
"They're all the same," I mutter. "Different colors, but basically the same ship."
"Grandmaster Spingate," the room says. "New contact detected. Labeling it Epsilon 1.
My heart sinks, weighed down by a sense of defeat, a feeling that no matter what we do, we will eventually lose. Zubiri turns her back to the red wall. She sags slowly, sits on her heels. She starts to cry.
"It will never end," she says. "Never."
"Silence on the bridge," Gaston snaps.
The sharpness of his voice startles me. Zubiri as well. She stops crying, looks up at him in confused surprise. I don't know what a bridge is, but Gaston seems to think he's in one.
"Show me the new contact," he says. "Global model and in scale."
"Processing, Captain Xander."
The image of white-fronted dragon dissipates in an angry shower of sparkles. Those sparkles rush together to form the familiar blue, green, and brown orb that is Omayokin. Big at first, wider than the width of the well, but the planet shrinks as if we're flying away from it. I see the Zolotl, now highlighted in glowing red. Then the basilisk, highlighted in glowing blue. As the planet shrinks, they quickly become nothing more than colored dots. Omayokin reduces to the size of Gaston's chest. The two moons blur into view, then shrink in time with the planet. A green dot appears. The goblin. When the planet is the size of Gaston's head, I see a white dot. The dragon. When Omayokin is as tiny as Gaston's eyeball, I see a fifth colored light. This one is purple.
"The purple dot represents Epsilon 1, Captain,"
the room says. Gaston stares.
"We'll call it the eel. Show me the eel's projected time to arrival in orbit."
A long curved purple line appears, connecting the new dot to Omayokin.
"At current rate of speed and factoring in deceleration, the eel will reach orbit in 15 months, 10 days, Captain Xander."
Gaston's shoulders sag. His veneer of leadership fades away. One of Matilda's school lessons flares to life in my thoughts. They taught her about solar systems, planets and their moons, all orbiting around a central star. That's what this display reminds me of, except the star is Omayokin, and the planets are alien ships. Alien ships coming to destroy us. Zubiri's cheeks gleam with tears, reflect the colored lights of this horrible reality.
"Where in hell?" she says. "Ship after ship after ship. They will keep coming. We'll never beat them all."
A high-pitched wail comes from the walls and ceiling.
"Alert, Captain Xander. Incoming projectile fire from the basilisk."
Gaston hops off the well and runs to join Spingate on the platform.
"Show me,"
he says, as he slides to a stop at the pedestal next to hers. Spingate's hands are already moving, grabbing floating images of light, moving them, twisting them.
"Attack level magnification,"
Omatiotl says. The glowing display of Omayokin swells like we are plummeting towards the planet. We don't see the entire orb anymore, just a curve of it. At the center, so small I barely recognize the huge city wall, I make out Ukmal and the surrounding jungle. High up above, the tiny blue dot of the basilisk. Thread-thin blue lines reach out from it, streaking down towards our city.
"How many projectiles in the first salvo?"
Gaston asks, his hands moving just as furiously as Spingate's.
17,
Omatiotl answers.
"Time to first impact, 13 minutes and 7 seconds.
"Are the missile defense batteries active?"
"Chancellor Borjigin confirms 3 of the 4 batteries are functioning, Captain. I have full control of physical systems. Targeting and tracking systems active."
"Fire at will," Gaston says. "Shoot the god's damn things down."
"As you command, Captain. I will initiate automated defense fire as soon as the projectiles enter the stratosphere."
Spingate's hands are a blur of light and color. I have no idea what she's doing.
I feel stupid and useless.
Batteries 1, 2, and 4 active, she says. A total of 31 combined anti-missile bursts available. That's not enough. Should we only target the projectiles aimed at the observatory?
Gaston snarls, thinks for a moment. I can almost see the anger simmering inside him.
If we only protect the observatory, they might figure out we're low on ammo, he says, talking out loud as he works through the problem.
There are no easy answers here. For once, I'm glad the decision is not mine to make.
The Basilisk is close enough to safely launch landing craft, Gaston says, but it hasn't yet. We have to assume that's coming. Make sure we can shoot down at least some of those ships. Omatiotl, target the first 20 projectiles, regardless of where they are aimed. Save the last 11 anti-missile bursts for incoming aircraft only. If the observatory or Zimbal are directly targeted, use those reserved rounds.
Affirmative, Captain.
He's making an impossible choice, protecting our people and our only working spaceship, possibly at the expense of being able to shoot down the alien ground troops. I could jump in. I could tell him what to do. But in all honesty, he knows more about air combat than I ever will. I trust him. Gaston glances at Spingate.
Battery 3, the one that doesn't work? Are there any rounds in there?
Spingate moves icons.
Another 12 rounds.
That gives us a little more breathing room, Gaston says. Omatiotl, tell Borjigin to have people evenly distribute the ammunition from Battery 3 to the other batteries.
Zubiri starts crying again. Maybe she's a genius scientist, but right now she looks like a terrified little 13-year-old girl. 12 minutes until the streaks of fire split our sky and shatter our city. 12 minutes.
Zubiri, I say. The telescope is working. Does that mean the Goff spear works? Can we shoot it?
She looks up at me, eyes wet and wide.
I haven't verified that yet. The Goff rounds are nuclear weapons. Without testing, we can't take a chance that they might malfunction and detonate inside the observatory.
A second enemy salvo has launched,
Omatiotl calls out.
17 additional projectiles. Time of impact estimated at 21 minutes, 14 seconds. Total incoming projectiles, 34.
Gaston points at Zubiri. While she looks like a little girl, he suddenly looks like a grown man.
Load the Goff spear, he growls. Immediately.
She shakes her head, screams back at him in a broken voice.
I just told you, I haven't had time to test it. For all I know, it could blow up instead of launching. It could kill us all.
Gaston looks at me, nods once, returns to his mad work above the pedestal. I'm the leader of our people. But with that brief glance, I realize that in here, he is in charge. And he has just given me orders. I walk to Zubiri and haul her to her feet.
Let's go, I say. We're loading that weapon.
That was episode 8 of Alone, book 3 of the Generations trilogy. Will M and Zubiri get the Goff spear working in time? Will the birthday children and their Springer allies survive the current attack? Find out next week on Alone, episode number 9. And until then, junkies, I will talk to you all real soon.
You have been listening to Alone, book 3 in the Generations trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Performed by A. Kovacs. Produced by Scott Sigler and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. Follow Scott on Twitter and Instagram, where his handle is at Scott Sigler, ScottSigler, one word, or join our Facebook group at facebook.com/Scott Sigler. Theme music is the song Unseen Horrors by Kevin MacLeod.